Let's open up to Jeremiah chapter 50, and we'll be picking up there and on question number 3 that we looked at and talked a little bit about on Sunday. We started in chapter 50 talking about the destruction of Babylon. That's the whole of chapter 50 on into chapter 51. We're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about the judgment that is coming on Babylon. And of course, this evening we're going to get into more of how that's connected to Israel, who, of course, is the recipient of all of this, right? They're the ones actually reading this. And in fact, in many instances, would be reading it after that destruction had already occurred. And so we want to think about what they're supposed to learn from that. But in that section of verses 11 through 16, we talked about the sort of jubilant, exultant demeanor of Babylon, and they are skipping about like a threshing heifer, whatever that means. One commentator noted that it may just mean like a cow that is tromping through grain, right? Not necessarily threshing out the grain, because that is probably not a happy heifer, but the one who would be trampling through the grain. But whatever the imagery there is, it's meant to be that things, that they just think everything's great. And then, of course, judgment is coming. But one of the things that we note there is it says that Babylon would surrender. And then it says that her walls would be torn down. Let's see there. It says, let's see here. Where am I looking? Skip about 15, yes. Raise a loud shout against her on every side. She has given herself up there. So it's different language in the LSB. In some it says she would surrender. The idea is to raise the hand or surrender the hand, which is a sign of surrender. Her pillars have fallen, and then her walls have been pulled down, for this is the vengeance of Yahweh. So the pillars falling and the walls being torn down, some commentators say that Jeremiah, or worse yet, God, made a threat, but it didn't actually turn out that way. Anybody know how Babylon, the city of Babylon, actually fell?
The Medes and the Persians were able to sneak through the water system, basically.
Yes.
And capture the city inside. They didn't have to break down the walls to get it.
All right. So the waters actually ran through the city. The Medes and the Persians diverted the river, and so that that riverbed was dry, that they could just kind of walk in under the walls. And in fact, things had deteriorated in the Babylonian Empire quite a bit at this point. And many of the people were not very pleased with their rulers. And so when they did breach the walls, they were actually welcomed by the citizens. There was very little in the way of sort of combat, normal combat, and certainly no tearing down of the walls. They just waltzed in. So some people would just look and say, look, you know, I mean, God made a threat. It just didn't actually play out that way. But notice what it says. You will surrender, then the walls will come down. And it actually is the case that about 30 years after the initial invasion of Babylon, the then king of Persia ordered that the walls of Babylon would be torn down in order to get the materials for other construction projects. So, in fact, it does play out like Jeremiah says. Not your walls are torn down, then you will surrender, which would kind of be the normal, you know, sort of order of things. He says here, you'll surrender, then your walls will be torn down. That's exactly what plays out. So I think that's of interest as you're looking through from the standpoint of people who are critics who come to the text and they want to find something to sort of be dismissive of the historicity of it. And in fact, as is so very often the case, it's the very opposite. It proves the historicity because it is out of the normal order. All right. So Babylon is going to be brought down. Well, continuing on, we have sort of a back and forth that seems to happen through a large portion of this text. And so the next section turns the attention back to Israel and what's going to be happening with regards to Israel, Sam. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, he does rehearse the going all the way back to the Northern Kingdom and Assyria. But in bringing that up, he does, when he says the judgment's going to come to Babylon, it will be like the judgment that has already come to Assyria. So this is, you know, this history's already sort of played out once, where a portion of God's people have been taken away by, you know, sort of a world-dominating power, the Assyrians, and they have been judged. You know, a nation that you wouldn't have thought could be judged was brought to judgment. That's what's about to happen again. And so he appeals back to it and says, just like Assyria, you know, I'm giving you a marker where you can look and you can know that this has happened before. That's what's going to happen again. As to the point there with regard to the restoration and the pardon, when will it be most fully true that the iniquity of Israel will not be there anymore and that there will be pardon for the remnant? When will that most fully be realized? Yeah, that's right. In the church, all right? And so here, yet again, we've got a promise being made to people who are in captivity, maybe coming out of captivity, and yet again, they don't fully reach the potential of this promise. It's a promise that's left unsatisfied. And we've been talking about that. There are several instances where a promise is made, but it's not fully satisfied. And it is fully satisfied in the kingdom. And of course, it's fully satisfied with the church becoming Israel, right? That's, and all those descriptors of Israel, the church takes on that mantle, that title of Israel, the children of Abraham. Notice there in verse 20, what does he say when he begins to talk about, what's the time marker there for these things happening? Yeah, what have we been saying about that phrase? In what days? It's pointing to the last days, in those days when all these things will be fulfilled. So we're kind of collecting. You could sort of just take all the passages where it begins with the marker in those days and just kind of collect them together, pile them up, and boy, you got a real pattern there, don't you? You know, of all these things that are going to happen in those days, that they all end up being things that are most fully recognized and realized in the time of Christ. And so just note that again there. All right. Well, in verse 21, we're back to the attention on the destruction of Babylon. And we have several points of imagery here. Carrie, what sorts of imagery are being used here with regards to the destruction of Babylon? Yeah, and so just several points. We're bringing up several types of imagery. In verse 23, the hammer of the whole earth, that's Babylon, right? They're the hammer, and now they're broken to pieces, right? So they're the ones who have instilled fear into all the other nations, and God has used them to smash the other nations, right? We've talked about that as he was bringing judgment on the other nations. Typically, and maybe in every case, Babylon is the tool he was using to accomplish each of those judgments that's being pronounced there. But now the one that was the hammer is going to be smashed and destroyed. Again, the idea of God here opening his armory, one translation had it his arsenal. I just shudder to think when God says, I'm going to open up, I'm going to use all the weapons that I have. You know, that's far more frightening than any powerful nation on this earth saying they're about to open up their armory or arsenal, is that God saying he's opening his arsenal. And so he's going to bring forth the weapons of his indignation. But I would say also in that when God says, I'm opening my arsenal, that when the destruction comes to Babylon, what does this mean?
It's from him.
Yes. Yeah. So whatever weapons get used, whatever people bring the weapons, it's people, you know, handling them, but it's God at the helm, right? God is the one who's bringing judgment. And again, we're seeing that. We saw that again in the judgment to the nations. We're going to see that over and over with Babylon. God wants the people of Israel, really mostly, I think, to know that the judgment comes from him. So again, that they don't think not only that the judgment to themselves is happenstance, but even that they don't think the judgment to the other nations is happenstance. But the Lord is bringing that to bear. Opening up the stores of grain, it seems to me that he's suggesting that it says, open up her barns, pile her up like heaps, and devote her to destruction. So it's not just like pillage their grain barns, but it's like they are stacked up like heaps of grain. I think the idea of the destruction, maybe even the dead bodies there in that instance. And then finally, verse 27, put all her young bulls to the sword and let them go down to the slaughter. So it's like animals being led away to the slaughter. Again, this could be literal, you know, but I think the idea would be like their young soldiers, right? The cream of their crop is being led away to the slaughter. And so in all of these ways, God is using just a number of pieces of imagery to basically say, you're going to be destroyed. Well, verse 29 gives us one, not all, but one primary element of their the cause of all this judgment. David, what's the sin that Babylon is being punished for? All right. So, do we see a pattern in some of these proclamations of judgment? Pride seems to be an overweening factor, especially when it comes to other nations, right? There's a much more diverse list of sins when Israel is at the forefront. But when God goes to other nations, I would say pride is probably the number one thing that God raises to the top and says, because of your pride, I'm going to bring you down. And certainly Edom, we see that, and other indications, maybe more subtle indications. But here, it very much sounds like Edom. You know, just that repetition, as you pointed out, over and over using all these different words to describe their arrogance. Back in verse 28... just backing up one verse from this section there, Notice, to add to this, he says, to declare in Zion the vengeance of Yahweh our God, vengeance for his temple. So I would just add this into that pride, which pride is the element I was looking for in this particular question, but just add to that their destruction of the temple. Now, in destroying the temple, what were they doing? What was Babylon doing when they destroyed the temple? God's will. So what's the problem? Do I? That was God's temple, right? But is there any way they could have done it and not received God's judgment?
They were certainly not doing it to try to fulfill God's will.
Yes.
They had their own reasons for doing that. And pride was a big part of that.
Yes.
Pride, desire for power.
Right. Right. I think there's a way, like Jehu, that they could have gone in and done this in obedience to God. But the fact that God wanted them to do it is just a matter of convenience. Right? This is something that, it's not like God told them to go destroy Jerusalem and they were like, well, okay. I mean, I'm not sure about that, but if God says so, then we'll do it. No, these people are doing this to every city and every nation. This is what they do. And just like the Assyrians, they have a very well established reputation as pillagers and destroyers. And so it's not like they've made an exception to go and be obedient to God in this one case. No, they are arrogant destroyers. And so God says, you came against my temple as arrogant destroyers. Even though God used their arrogance for his own purposes. But then he will judge their arrogance. And I think the same thing is true with regards to any wicked ruler that God uses. Whether God uses Pharaoh and his arrogance. Whether God uses Judas in his greed. That doesn't make Judas a good guy. And I think that there's pieces of literature sometimes that try to do that and say, well, you know, you got to have the bad guy in order to have the good guy. It doesn't work like that. That guy's still a bad guy. And so Babylon is still a wicked nation and deserving of judgment for the way and the mindset that they had when they came against God, his people, and his temple. All right. Andrew. Yeah. Yes, and I think as we go along, we might even see a reference to that here in just a moment. All right, picking up in this next section then, and continuing on the idea of the destruction of Babylon, what does this next section have to say as far as the extent of that destruction, Brent? Yeah. And so I like how you say that. Pretty much everything. It attaches that same word, the sword to this, the sword to this, the sword to this. And I'm just going to go down the list, right? Is there anything left out? And even, as you look down towards the end of that section in verse 38, a drought on her waters, the word drought even, is almost identical to the word sword. So maybe even that's a play on words there, that it's a sword. In fact, some of your translations might even have a footnote there. I think the New American Standard has a footnote that this could be translated sword. So a sword on the waters. So in every way, he's basically bringing the invaders, as it were, against them. And it says, Here we add to the reasons. We have pride there listed in the previous section here. A drought on her waters and they will be dried up. For it is a land of graven images and they are mad over terrifying idols. Particularly, when we've seen God's pronouncing judgment, he seems to most of the time bring up their trust in their idols. And he is going to, just like he did with Egypt, just demolish their trust in their idols. And maybe in just as creative a ways as he did in Egypt, sort of undermining, the very things that those, deities claimed power over. Verse 39, if you did much study, you might be looking and saying, what is the deal? Every translation seems to have a different animal, in verse 39. Here it says in the LSB, the desert creatures will live there along with the jackals and the ostriches will also live in it. And it will never again be lived in or dwelt in from generation to generation. The issue there is that the words there are similar to animal names, but they just don't know what animals they are. They are animals that live in the desert, and that's what they know. So they're guessing what animals they are and putting those in place. You see a lot of that in the Proverbs too, where you could see lizard or spider, which don't sound like really similar animals, but they're just not sure what this word is in that case. And so they're looking at the context and trying to guess what that animal is. But the idea is it's animals who live where people don't. That's what we're sure of, in this context. And so, that's what is being described in this case. Some of your translations will even say something like demons or desert demons, which again would be, even entities which dwell where people don't. But to conclude all of that, as Brent mentioned, the appeal to Sodom and Gomorrah. That is total devastation and becomes a byword, as it were. All right. Where's this judgment coming from, Jacob?
Well, verse 41 mentions this people shall come from the north, the great nation of many kings would be raised up from the ends of the earth. So from other places in the Bible as well as secular history, we know that Babylon is taken over by a sort of confederacy between the Medes and the we talked about that idea of from the north before. The Medes, I think, technically maybe to the north. So
right.
Maybe that has that in mind. Or it could just be an expression that's used
yep.
at this point.
Yeah. Higher latitude, yeah. Not necessarily due north.
Right, yeah. It goes on to describe this people that's coming in very poetic language. Ride on horses, their voice will roar like the sea. And in verse 43, it talks about the response of the king of Babylon. About the anguish and the fear he would have. And certainly, you know, we see in Daniel chapter 5, when it's describing eventually the destruction of Babylon, the reaction of Belshazzar to the handwriting on the wall, you know, maybe that's kind of that same fear being played out there.
Yes. Yes. All right. So a couple of things to note about the particular language that's being used here with this destruction from the north. And as you mentioned, it's the Confederacy, the Medes and the Persians. And we'll see that more specifically as we go on into the next chapter here. But notice here, beginning in verse 41, behold, a people is coming from the north and a great nation and many kings will be aroused from the remotest parts of the earth. The Confederacy. They seize their bow and javelin. They are cruel and have no compassion. Their voice roars like the sea and they ride on horses, arranged like a man for battle against you, O daughter of Babylon. The king of Babylon has heard the report about them and his hand hangs limp. His hands hang limp. Distress has taken hold of him. Agony like a woman in childbirth. All right. Look back over at Jeremiah chapter 6 and verse 22, Jeremiah 6 and verse 22. Thus says Yahweh, behold, a people is coming from the land of the north, and a great nation will be aroused from the remote parts of the earth. They take hold of the bow and the spear. They are cruel and have no compassion. Their voice roars like the sea, and they ride on horses. They says, let's see, they ride on horses, arranged as a man for battle against you, O daughter of Zion. We have heard the report of it. Our hands are limp. Distress has taken hold of us as pain, of a woman in childbirth. Now, who's the army of the north there, and who are they coming against? Yeah. So now Jeremiah's using almost exactly the same language that he used to tell Israel that Babylon was coming. Now he's turned it towards Babylon to say, there's an army, sounds a lot like you, coming towards you. And your reaction is going to be the same as what Israel's was. They are now going to be in the position, the very position of the ones that they had overtaken there.
There's some poetic justice there. I can't put my finger on the verse, but somewhere in all this it says, as you have done, so will it be done to you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so, and then continuing on there in verse 44, behold, one will come up like a lion from the thicket of Jordan into an enduring pasture. For in an instant, I will make them run away from it, and whoever is chosen, I will point over it. For who is like me, and who will summon me into court? And who then is the shepherd who can stand before me? Therefore, we hear the counsel of Yahweh, which he has counseled against Babylon, and so on. Turn back over to chapter 49. And there in verse 19, chapter 49, verse 19, behold, one will come up like a lion from the thickets of the Jordan against an enduring pasture. For in an instant, I will make him run away from it. And whoever is chosen shall appoint over it. For who is like me, and who will summon me into court? And who then is the shepherd who can stand against me? Hear the counsel of Yahweh and so forth against Edom and his purposes, which he purposed against the inhabitants of Teman and so forth. So we have two references, actually. In the first instance, it's an almost exact reference to the destruction that was coming against Israel or Jerusalem. And now it's an almost exact reference of the judgment that was coming against Edom. Now, obviously, we can get the connection with the destruction that's coming against Jerusalem that Babylon would bring. What do you think the destruction against Edom, how that might be of use or value here in using that same language? Yes, absolutely. Pride is highlighted in both judgments. What else? Yes. Okay. So Brad said that Edom is often used as a reference to all of the nations. Again, a play on words. The word Edom, and you can almost hear it in the English, is one letter off from the word Adam. So it makes a good stand-in for mankind, right? The very word Edom makes a good stand-in for mankind. And so the prophets use it that way. So sometimes you have to discern whether or not the prophet is specifically referencing Edom, the actual nation, or if he's using it figurative. Now, I think Jeremiah is specifically, as we see him in a list of nations, I think he is specifically referencing Edom. And I'm not saying you weren't saying that. But having said that, there could also still be that reference. Now, I wonder if Israel, in reading this, is not only seeing that God is bringing the very judgment against Babylon that Babylon brought against Israel, but that they also see that Babylon is being judged like all the other nations, even Edom, which is not very big. You know, right? As far as you look at the nations that are being described here, Edom would be among the lowlier of those peoples. And so it's not like Babylon is some special case to God. They get the same treatment. God is coming against them. And so it kind of flattens out our picture of the nations. Like you would think, I mean, there's Babylon, and God just puts them right on the level with everybody else. And that would be, I think, important for Israel to see that, that to God, it's not like he's having to roll up his sleeves and boy, I'm going to have to really work hard. No, he's doing the same thing he's already done to all the other nations. All right. Any other ideas or thoughts on chapter 50 before we move into chapter 51? Of course, we're progressing here in the same thought pattern. We're continuing in the judgment here to Babylon. So as we open up chapter 51, again, we're still on the same subject. And what is it that's going to happen to the army of Babylon, Garrett? Yes. And again, if you're looking at verse 3, there's a couple of different ways that people translate that. Some of it looks like bend your bow, and then some of it, like here in the LSB, says let not him who bends his bow bend it. If he's saying bend your bow, then maybe that's a command to the invading armies. And if he's saying don't, then maybe this is much like, and this is the direction I would lean, like the LSB does here, that it would be much like the instruction to Jerusalem. Don't even try. Don't. And in fact, they don't. Don't put up a resistance. This is from the Lord. It is judgment, from him. So, incidentally, there in verse 1, when he says, I'm going to arouse against Babylon and against the inhabitants of Lebkamai. Lebkamai is, let me think of the term. It's an Atbash. All right. That's a Hebrew, basically, anagram where you take different letters. It's a code, if you will. I don't like to use that word code because it sounds like they're trying to keep something secret. And obviously he's not, because he has Babylon in the same line there. So it's not like he's trying to avoid anybody knowing who he's talking about. It's a word play on Babylon. And, the way that works is basically you kind of turn the alphabet around backwards and then you spell it out on the same positions with the alphabet turned backwards. All right. Now, I think that may communicate an insult, right? To basically refer to Babylon in this way, maybe an insulting way to refer to Babylon. It's been turned upside down, turned on its head. That's a possibility. What's not a possibility, again, as I say, is that Jeremiah is using coded language so he doesn't get in trouble. It's very clear who he's talking about here. Another wordplay element here in verse 2, he says, I will send strangers to Babylon that they may winnow her. The word strangers or foreigners, again, is the same consonants, the same Hebrew letters as the word winnow. And it's just a matter of a different vowel pronunciation. So the winnow there is being brought in, the strangers. So the winnowers, we might translate it, that they may winnow her. And we've seen that all through where there's sort of a play on words as these destructions are being pronounced. But as Garrett pointed out, there's just no point. There's no point in fighting back. It's going to be total destruction. Okay. Picking up in verse 5, we've come to another point where we're once again turning our attention back to Judah, back to Israel and Judah. How does the destruction of Babylon relate in this passage, John Michael?
Reiterated in verse 45, while Babylon's
Yeah. Yeah. And that, even though she could have been healed, the take balm for her pain. Again, that is the very same language that Jeremiah used for Israel. Don't you have balm in Gilead? And I think there's, again, another allusion there, as Babylon's going down to the connections between her destruction, and Israel's destruction. That word vindication, there, that there's vindication for God's people. In the New American Standard, it has that language there. It doesn't mean that she's vindicated and that she was right all along. It's more of release from captivity. Vindicated as in released from bondage. The phrase here, Yahweh has brought about our righteousness. And I think that is, that righteousness is the return to their home. Their return to the city of Zion, which it says is where they would proclaim this. So that Yahweh's brought about our righteousness is the word that's, vindication there in the New American Standard, I think it is. Yes.
That verse 5, for Israel is not forsaken, nor Judah, by his God, the Lord of hosts, though their land was filled with sin against the Holy One of Israel. I've heard a guy do some lessons on Romans 10 and 11, and a class on Romans 10 and 11. It sounds a lot like Romans 10 and 11. It seems like Paul could have just pointed back at this verse and said, what are you talking about? What do you mean God hasn't given you a chance? He got rid of other nations for less.
Yeah.
But he preserved you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that seed's planted all through, you know, that you have been given particular privilege. And it's not that the other nations haven't been given privilege as well, just not as much as you. You've been given an overabundance of it. And of course, as he does state in chapter 2, you've scorned it. You know, you've wasted all of that. I would note verse 7. Babylon has been a golden cup in the hand of Yahweh. I think there's an interesting, at least in my mind, a connection to make. What is Belshazzar doing when the handwriting comes and then the destruction? With a golden cup in his hand, right? God's golden cup in his hand. And so I wonder if there's a connection being made here that you've been a golden cup in my hand. And I've used you for my purposes, but now I'm tossing you to the side. And the point at which he does that is the very moment when this Belshazzar is holding God's golden cup in his hand. And God sort of strips it from his hand as well as everything else from his power. All right, we will pick up there with question 11 and verse 11 on Sunday morning. Appreciate everybody's good attention.